Breakthrough.
You are now listening to Breakthrough News. It's 5 p.m. You're listening to Breakthrough News, and this is The Punch Out. We're following the news all day so you don't have to, giving you everything you need to know about what's in the headlines and what should be. And yes, we are back here on The Punch Out, 25th of October, 2021. Very happy to be back with you here on the show. And we've got plenty for you here, as we always do. We're going to be talking about the pretty dire climate outlook ahead of COP26. We're going to talk about Sudan, which is being rocked by a coup as we speak. But before we get to either of those two very important stories, we're going to be talking about how Congress is cutting the budget to the bone. Well, Democrats are moving towards a compromise, they say, on their budget bill as negotiators in the White House and on Capitol Hill rush to cut all sorts of critical funding from a range of programs to meet the whims of corporate America and their designated representatives in Congress. It's hard to know exactly where things stand, but there are some broad outlines. The pro-corporate so-called compromise combines a range of outright cuts and/or shortened authorization limits in order to reach a totally arbitrary number of around $2 trillion in spending. And this, in and of itself, is notable. That literally nothing in either the budget reconciliation bill being proposed solely by Democrats or the infrastructure bill, which is twinned with it and has some Republican support, is being negotiated or based on the actual needs or scale of the problems to be solved. In reality, what is happening in both cases is the final dollar amount of the bill is being determined by what can be paid for through a variety of essentially tax gimmicks. The key stumbling blocks in both bills is that spending that comes close to addressing the need or the scale is spending that corporate America and the wealthiest Americans do not want to pay for with an additional dime in taxes. And also that big pharma does not want drug prices to come down, even a little bit, and that the energy sector does not really want to move towards clean energy. So when you put all those things together, nothing is really going to happen. So in other words, what we are now left with is what's left after the biggest corporations and the richest people in the country have exercised their veto over the process through their majority in Congress, which consists of the entire Republican Party and a clutch of conservative Democrats. So what is left? Well, on the healthcare front, lowering the eligibility age of Medicare from 60 to 55 is out. Expanding Medicare benefits to vision and hearing seems to still be in, but dental is either totally out or it's going to be transformed from dental coverage to an $800 a year dental voucher for senior citizens on Medicare. And the changes here are a result of the fact that efforts to lower the price of prescription drugs is also out. The plan to expand Medicare was dependent on allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices with Big Pharma. Since Medicare is a huge program, they should be able to get huge savings. In fact, they were expecting about $700 billion worth of savings, which would pay for the broader expansion of Medicare to people 55 and up, and also to cover vision, dental, and hearing. So since the idea of negotiating drug prices was dropped out, the expansion is smaller. There is some discussion in allowing there to be some negotiating of drugs and something called Medicare Part B, and that's essentially drugs that you would not self-administer. It's things that mainly you'd get in a hospital, like drugs that are given through an IV. And that won't glean very much in terms of savings at all, really. And more or less, most of it would not be seen in your average medical bill, but it might actually pay for some of this much more limited expansion. As it concerns the issue of the Medicaid coverage gap, that's providing Medicaid for the 2 million people who are eligible but live in states that refuse to expand Medicaid, well, that's technically still in, but it would only be authorized for the next 3 years. So after that, it could lapse. And the same thing is true regarding increased subsidies for people to cover the cost of their health insurance via the Affordable Care Act exchanges. Free community college is out. Paid leave, well, could be out, could be in. But if it is included, it will only be 4 weeks and it will be means tested and the program will expire in 3 to 4 years. Prior to these cuts, it was supposed to be 12 weeks, by the way. As for childcare and universal pre-K, well, it isn't really clear at all what's going on there. Both things could actually be totally dropped, and a range of issues have emerged there. But most notably, the business lobby has seized on a progressive critique of the Biden proposal that noted, because of the way the subsidies are designed, the plan will actually raise costs for childcare for everyone not covered by a subsidy, meaning a good number of working families could see a dramatic increase, perhaps as much as $13,000 a year, in the cost of childcare. Now, of course, that could be fixed relatively easily by just making the program universal rather than means tested, but that also seems unlikely to happen. So the bad design by Democrats could actually sink the entire proposal for increased subsidies for childcare cost. The 80% clean energy standard by 2030 is out, meaning that there is essentially nothing substantive on climate in either the budget bill or the infrastructure bill, despite looming planetary catastrophe. Housing aid is being cut across the board, the overall number being reduced from $337 billion to somewhere between $150 to $175 billion, allegedly. And to give some sense of the impact here, before these cuts, the proposed spending would have eliminated the repair backlog in public housing. What is currently being proposed would be $5 billion less than the lowball estimate of what is needed to get public housing up to code around the country. As for home health care aides, well, the original proposed amount has already been cut in half during negotiations, and according to Politico, could be cut even more. So who knows where that's going, but it's not trending well. This all raises some key questions of what to make of all of this. Democrats, of course, will say, well, it's great. It all worked out. Democracy is what it is, so on and so forth. It's the best we could do. Now, we could parse that issue until the cows come home, but it seems like there's a better way to look at the whole thing as a barometer of where things stand in terms of the relationship of forces in the country. Like I said, the cuts are essentially what's left after the veto by the wealthy. So looking at it that way, there are some things we can say about the two major parties. We can say for sure that they won't fix all the bridges and dams that could collapse or the pipes that are filled with lead poison, just some of them. We know that they won't address the terrible for-profit healthcare system. They won't take any significant action to lower prescription drug prices on that front, and they won't allow any sort of competitor to the broader insurance system to emerge. They'll just shovel subsidies into the existing system. We know that they won't take serious action to lower the cost of higher education or reduce the debts incurred by those who are already giving their pound of flesh to the student loan industry. We also know that they won't take action to raise the minimum wage or substantially increase wages in sectors like home health care and child care, where wages are still hovering at, around, or just above the poverty line. And of course, we know, underlying all this, that they won't raise taxes on the wealthiest businesses and the wealthiest people, no matter what the problem it helps solve or whose life it improves. And this, of course, is all with the Democrats in charge. So when people say, what's the difference between Democrats and Republicans, it gives you a pretty good sense. If you put Democrats in charge, the best you can expect is tinkering around the edges, very limited means-tested social programs. And if there's anything that might be somewhat expansive, it'll only happen in the least effective possible way that boils down to very expensive subsidies to terrible industries. So if you actually want substantive change, like to save the planet from being destroyed, making sure people have access to quality health care, housing, and education as a right, not a privilege, if you want the bridges not to collapse on you and the water not to be poisoned, among other things, you can say, for absolute certain, you can't count on either of the two main political parties to take you there. Well, the situation in Sudan has escalated rapidly since we mentioned it to you towards the end of last week. Early this morning, well, on East Coast time here in the United States, that is, the Sudanese military launched a coup and arrested the Prime Minister, Abdullah Hamdok, and other senior officials. At the time we went to press, three people had been killed and 80 wounded as security forces allied with the military sought to repress the mass protests that broke out almost immediately after the news of the coup broke. The coup is taking place in the context of what can be described as a three-way fight, so to speak. In 2019, the government that had been in power since 1989 was deposed as a result of huge mass protest. The mass protest led elements of the military to dump the then government and ally with the protesters. In the immediate aftermath of these events, the military and some elements of the protest movement, under the moniker of the Forces for Freedom and Change, decided to set up a condominium government, where the civilian side would set up the cabinet, the military side would deal with security and, well, a range of other things. Ultimately, the exact power balance was never exactly clear. Not all of those involved in the protest movement, however, agreed with this and felt that this agreement was likely to forestall change rather than push it even further. shuffling the deck chairs among the elite rather than lead to a fundamentally changed social and economic reality would be another way to put that. This has been the position, by the way, of the Sudanese Communist Party and also some of the resistance committees and professional associations that played a major role in the first stage of the broader process that began in 2019. These disagreements really started to break into the open in the past month when there was an attempted coup about a month ago. That coup brought into the open a few major issues. First and foremost, the lack of any real progress in the social and economic situation in the country. The average family has seen a 60 to 85% reduction in purchasing power in that time, just in the context of the massive inflation spikes for food, medicine, and so on. Just to give you a sense of how people are living here, the government program, which is designed to aid people because of this massive increases in prices, gives out only $5 a month. That $5 a month is still not enough to cover basic medicines and is widely seen as being inadequate to provide proper nutrition as well. And this is in a country where already prior to what happened in 2019, 9 out of every 10 people live on less than a dollar a day. 40% of people lack access to clean water. Just over a third of school-age children are out of school. And not to mention, there are extremely high rates of malnutrition, stunting, and so on. In fact, the situation there is so dire that about one quarter of the population is not expected to live past 25. Sudan also has one of the highest numbers of internally displaced people in the world and is still dealing with the legacy of a range of armed conflicts and also facing serious challenges with drought as climate change gets worse. Most people see the government is doing very little to address these issues, which, in the midst of conversations about major debt relief and aid funding coming into the country, undoubtedly raises serious questions in the minds of the people over what is really changing, if anything. That being said, the Forces for Freedom and Change recently split after last month's coup. One side, which seems to be the majority of the FFC, continued to back the civilian government and, in fact, demanded an all-civilian government, saying the military should step back, and the broader implication being that the military is responsible for most of the problems. The other side of the FFC backed the military, claiming that the military was right and that, in fact, the civilian side of the government was responsible for all the problems and that nothing could be done until, at the very least, there was a cabinet reshuffle of this quote-unquote civilian-led government. But some in that camp were already calling last week for the military to just take power themselves and push the civilian side out, which appears to be what's happening right now. Then there was a third side to the whole thing. Remember, we said it was a three-way fight, and that contains groups like the Sudanese Communist Party and other important professional associations that play a key mobilizing role, along with some of the resistance committees that also emerged in 2019 and played a key mobilizing role in that mass movement at the base. These groups have been critiquing both sides the whole time, arguing that within all the camps in the government, civilian or military, there's more of a desire for power within a modification of the pre-2019 status quo, as opposed to a real desire for revolution and change. Now, this third side, if you will, has called for the ongoing coup to be defeated and is playing an important role, calling people out into the street to oppose these actions. And so far, very large numbers, thousands, some say tens of thousands, some even saying more than that, have come out in the capital of Khartoum behind these calls to oppose the coup. All sides have been trying to claim the hidden hand of the former government that was overturned in 2019 being behind their opponents. The truth of that isn't known to us, but it is worth noting that the military side of this did used to be involved in that part of the government. So take that for what you will. So all told, what we are seeing is essentially part two of what we saw in 2019. The mass protests then totally destabilized the existing setup, but did not fully resolve important contradictions about the direction Sudanese society was going to take. A hard break from the past or continuation of the status quo. And it's now those contradictions that are erupting. Well, we are right here on the verge of the COP26 meeting in Scotland on the issue of climate change. And with that in mind, you may be wondering, well, how's the planet doing? Unfortunately, not great. Currently, we are on track as a planet for global temperatures to rise by 3 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. Now, you could say that's better than the 4 degrees, which is where things stood in 2014, but it is well above the 1.5 degrees that is seen as the only chance of avoiding serious and likely catastrophic damage to the world we live in. Even including pledges by all nations, the pledges on paper, that is, let's say all those get done, we're still on track for a 2 to 2.5 degree rise. Now, these numbers are sort of hard to understand in the abstract and often obscure how bad things could get. But just to give you some examples, a rise of between 2 to 3 degrees means the ice sheets atop Greenland and Antarctica will irreversibly melt, causing literally centuries of rising sea levels that will essentially eliminate the coastal cities as we know them today. At least 275 million people would be flooded out of their homes in cities as diverse as Miami, Alexandria, Egypt, Shanghai, Osaka, and The Hague. An Australian study estimates that at 3 degrees in that country, 265 days out of the year would be designated heat stress days. Also, 99% of all coral reefs in Australia would die off. So the Great Barrier Reef, that's there in Australia, maybe you've heard about it, that would be gone at 3 degrees. May actually be gone anyway. In fact, it's so bad, a rise of 3 degrees by the end of the century, there isn't even really that much modeling done on how big an impact it will have. I mean, it's likely that large parts of the earth will simply become uninhabitable. Whole jungles could turn into deserts, and growing crops like wheat will become hard to do in many parts of the world. So people are hesitant to make too many predictions because it'll probably be so bad, you can't even really predict how much so. But here's another thing I'll just throw at you to give you some sense. Many people noted across the summer the impact of extreme rains on creating flash flooding in places that didn't expect it. Well, at 3 degrees warming, the amount of, in the words of the UN, quote, extreme daily precipitation will increase by 21%. On top of that, major droughts will increase by about 3 times. Again, this is all fairly speculative since 3 degrees of warming is considered to be a truly catastrophic situation. I can't stress this enough. 3 degrees of warming is exactly where the planet is headed without drastic change in the opposite direction. And right now, there is no indication that there is going to be that type of rapid change. In fact, the United States, one of the key countries that needs to make a rapid turn, is in the midst of a discussion in Congress about doing nothing, at least nothing substantive, on the climate. So it gives you a sense of where we're really headed. I mean, the Earth literally is descending into a death spiral, yet all around the world, elites continue to fiddle while everything else burns. That's the punch out for today. We're with you Monday through Friday, 5 p.m. here in New York, East Coast Standard Time, 2 p.m. in Los Angeles, Pacific Standard Time, and 9 p.m. GMT. And of course, you can support everything we do here at Breakthrough News at patreon.com/breakthroughnews. It's your patronage that keeps all of our offerings here at Breakthrough News moving forward. And of course, you can check us out across all your social media platforms, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, at BT Newsroom.